Hey everyone, this is part six, a preview for this episode of our series on women's labor history in the United States. It is such an awesome episode, and if you'd like to listen to the full thing, become a patron at patreon.com/workstoppage. It's the only way that we get any funding for doing this show. It's the whole reason that there is a paywall in the first place. But, you know, this preview also, I try to make them long enough so that they're enjoyable, and I guess without any further ado, I'll let you get right to it. Solidarity.
The work by these auxiliaries was absolutely critical. Like feeding the mass of workers sitting down at GM was a massive logistical undertaking. It took 200 supporters, mostly women, to handle the enormous amount of food, which included 500 pounds of meat, 300 loaves of bread, 100 pounds of potatoes, 100 pounds of coffee, and 30 gallons of milk every day.
Jesus could never. Loaves and fish is my ass.
No, but like, that is seriously so much. Every single day, like, that I'm just like, I'm just thinking, like, you got 500 pounds of meat, 300 loaves of bread. You just split that amongst 500 women, assuming it's equally made by each person.
200.
Oh, yeah, 200 people. It's just like, that's so much. That's a lot of cooking.
And that's a lot to do under ideal conditions. But this was under essentially the conditions of war, because police and company guards attacked the women's picket while they were handing food to the men sitting down on January 11th in an attempt to cut off the strikers' supplies. But that was not as effective as the police thought it would be.
Yeah, this isn't the Napoleonic Wars. So.
And so the women rallied and fought back, with Janora Johnson, wife of one of the strikers, taking charge of the sound car that the union had deployed to rally the women picketers.
Cowards, cowards, shooting unarmed and defenseless men. Women of Flint, this is your fight. Join the picket line and defend your jobs, your husband's jobs, and your children's homes.
That's so fucking cool. And I don't know for sure, but I got to imagine that the sound car is just a car with a great big bullhorn on top.
Yes.
So you're just cruising around shouting this like inspirational shit into the mic while you drive this Buick or whatever. Like, it was pretty badass.
Yeah, like Victor Reuther famously like took control of the sound car like during one of the biggest pitch battles like during the formation of the UAW, and was like which was like really crucial to like rallying people while they're being attacked by the police. Yeah, so like that's the thing. It's like they're making all this food and then having to deliver it while basically doing combat drops. like to the striking workers.
The struggle is real.
Yeah, I mean, very much like as much engaged in the actual like combat of this struggle as the strikers, if not actually potentially more so, because they're the ones having to go back and forth from the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And so the victory at the Battle of Bull's Run, one of the biggest of these struggles, which was only possible through the support of the Women's Auxiliary, stamped the UAW into history and brought thousands into the Union. Following that battle, Janora Johnson established the Women's Emergency Brigade to act as a flying squadron, ready and able to be dispatched to any strike to walk the picket lines. The brigades operated with strict military precision, capable of mobilizing thousands within a few hours. They provided picket support, food, medical assistance, and some even came to pickets armed with 2x4s and other clubs to fend off police attacks.
And Brad.
During another sit-down at Chevrolet, the emergency brigade acted as a decoy, luring the police to one plant while striking workers were occupying a different one.
Loud 2 hours.
Yeah, also, yeah, like when they said they were doing callbacks with the stand-up strike to these things, I mean, that right there is a perfect example.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Faking them out about which plants were going to get struck was like a really critical thing that they did just recently.
Yeah, and when the strikers were attacked with tear gas in the plants to try and flush them out, emergency brigade women immediately began smashing all the windows in the plant so that it would vent all the gas out and so that it would help the strikers breathe.
Hell yeah.
A report at the time said,
quote, "The rally effect of the women's brigade is felt on every hand. Whenever the brigade appears, the workers rush to the roofs and windows of the plants to cheer and applaud them." End quote. That's so fucking cool.
Right? And so women's auxiliaries also marched the picket lines with CIO steel workers in mid-1937. The fight at Republic Steel in Chicago turned bloody as police savagely beat strikers and fired into unarmed pickets, wounding several women picketers. Women workers directly participated in several sit-down strikes in Detroit that year, including by bakers and cigar workers. Women workers also launched a week-long sit-down strike at the F.W. Woolworth's chain, starting out during the Saturday rush, which I gotta say, we need to, I want to bring these back just because I want to experience this, like at a store. Like, I'm just like, imagine like being at a store and then suddenly every worker's like, oh, nope, sit down, strike.
Yeah.
Like that rules. And so this strike at Woolworth's won the workers union recognition, paid vacation, a raise, and half pay for the week while they were on strike.
They got back pay. Like,
well,
for not being at work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, getting the company to pay for your strike, I think, is that's pretty fucking good.
Yeah. I mean, I really think that's a testament to how powerful these unified sit-down strikes really were. So inspired by the victory of the Detroit workers, women at Woolworth's, as well as other chain stores, workers at Grands and H.L. Greens in New York City also held successful sit-down strikes for union recognition, higher wages, paid vacation, and an eight-hour day. Women at all the hosiery mills in Reading, Pennsylvania, launched a general sit-down strike for a month, winning union recognition and the first collective bargaining agreement in the entire industry, securing dues checkoff and arbitration procedures. And really, from 1936 until 1939, when the Supreme Court ruled them illegal, sit-down strikes were a tremendous weapon for the working class fighting out of the depths of the Depression.
Yeah, the wins that were gotten here definitely explained why the Supreme Court was like, oh, no, we can't have this.
Yeah.
How do we fight this?
Yeah, well, because that's the thing, is they recognize it's like, well, there really isn't a good way to fight back against this. The only way that the company can do it without the state stepping in is through pure repression. And first off, that's a risky maneuver, because, like, are you really going to win if you're up against a factory of 9,000 workers? Like, I don't really know if it matters how many, like, goons you bring in. That's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, even if you try to go full bore, like, you know, when we talked about on the story about, like, El Golpe on the workers in Mexico in the 90s, where they just brought in guys with guns to try to, attack the workers who are occupying the plant. Even that didn't work. So, like, and that's way later, and those people had submachine guns. So, like, to your point, Lena, like, the bosses were simply paralyzed by this tactic, and they had to call in their friends in the state to come in and be like, no, you can't do that. And if you do, then we'll bring in the National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and the thing is, time and time again throughout history, that's what we see them do. Like 1877, after the Great Railroad Strike, that's why the National Guard was formed in the first place. That's why you see all the big, like, castle-like armories in so many cities in the East. And here again, the banning of the sit-down strike. Like, it's, if folks ever wanted to see the class nature of the state, this is a great way to view it. So by 1940, the number of women union members was more than triple the pre-Depression number of 250,000. The vast majority of the explosive growth of union density among women workers was from the industrial unions in the CIO. While the AFL did grow during this period as well, largely due to pressure from the CIO, it was nothing like the meteoric rise of the latter organization. The new federation's industrial approach was wildly successful, breaking down false distinctions not only on craft lines, but on the lines of sex and race as well, as the IWW had done before being largely destroyed in the first Red Scare. And that brings us to World War II.
The Hidden Army drew fresh recruits. Its ranks grew to nearly 18 million. Many of these women came from walks of life not previously considered. The mothers, the young, the aged. When they were asked why they had joined the ranks of the Hidden Army, these women gave a variety of reasons.
I have a daughter in the Waves, and I had a son on the Arizona. That's a good enough reason for anyone.
I'm an old maid, and I didn't have anyone until I took this defense job. Now, I have a family of 10 million to look after. I send them cases of these every week to help them to get home soon.
I go to college, but I arrange my classes so that I can help out in the war effort. This way I'll get my diploma and war bonds. I was too heavy for the wax, so I joined up in defense work. Yesterday was the big day of my life. The foreman told me I was worth my weight in gold.
My husband's a prisoner of the Japs in the Philippines. If he'd had a few more of these shells out in Bataan, maybe he'd still be fighting. Whenever I get a bit tired, I think of him on that death march.
So that's how American propaganda was talking about the introduction of women workers into the workforce.
Yeah, I mean, that was utterly unkind to women and also about nine different other groups that I could list right off the top of my head.
Yeah, that was definitely to go with the lightest one, to hear someone call themselves an old maid was definitely something to hear.
I laughed out loud when I heard the line, "I've got a family of 10 million to look after."
Yeah. What? Yeah, well, because the undertones there are so much. It's like, are you an older, unmarried, non-working woman who was completely purposeless before the war? And really, like, because this is the thing. Like, the undercurrent there, not necessarily the overt part of it, what they're saying is that, like, she had no purpose before becoming part of the great war machine of democracy. Yeah. And, like, I guess it's not as overtly fascist as the fascist propaganda, but, like, there's some parts there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, it's very weird because it is all, like, smiles and shiny stuff and, like, oh, we're joining the war effort. But the undertone is, like, are you a rudderless spinster?
Right.
Are you a useless old hag? Finally, something for you to do. And it's like, this is incredibly offensive.
It's like, through supporting the war effort, you can be a real person.
The one lady who's like, the farmer told me I was worth my weight in gold. Like, that's a deep type of literary cruelty to subject somebody to come on camera and be like, say the line.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, to make her say that.
I know.
Like, it's bad enough if it was the narrator.
It was I was too fat to be of any use to society. Yeah. Now look at me. I'm again, worth my weight in gold. It's like, wow. Yeah. So fucked up.
So, you know, one of the other things, though, to take away from that clip is that, you know, the decades of resistance by conservative craft unions and patriarchal bosses to women in the workplace would be totally transformed when the U.S. entered World War II, even if the ideology around it was not necessarily immediately transformed as well. With millions of men rushing into the armed services and defense orders through the roof, millions of women were needed to run the munitions plants. State propaganda at the time emphasized the oppression of women under fascism, favorably comparing the situation in the still very misogynistic United States, as you heard in the clip. And there was an enormous shift in the demographics of the workforce. Women went from 25% of the workforce before the war to 38% during the war, requiring many companies to drop their arbitrary distinction between men's work and women's work, which was, like, not real and just something they made up.
And still a thing you hear out of the mouths of Cotton Hill-ass dudes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. By war's end, women had entered nearly every field imaginable, proving what women workers had always known, that there was no job that they could not do just as well as men. By the end of the war, nearly half the workers in the aircraft industry were women. A majority of the radio and communications equipment industry workers were women as well by 1945. The war also largely erased the formal prejudice, key here being formal, not necessarily ideological, against married women workers, with nearly all industries dropping their previous bans on hiring married women. But
all the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie, the riveter, keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage. Sitting up there on the fuselage, that little frail can do more than a male can do. Rosie, the riveter, Rosie's got a boyfriend, Charlie. Charlie, he's a Marine. Rosie is protecting Charlie. working overtime on the riveting machine. When they gave her a production knee, she was as proud as a girl could be. There's something true about red, white, and blue about Rosie the Riveter. Rosie, 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 the Riveter on the assembly line.